Hello, and welcome to the third series in the Mystagogy program, hosted by the Adult Faith Programs at St. Stephen Martyr Church in Chesapeake, Virginia. For those of you who might be new to the Mystagogy podcast, in Greek, the word mystagogy means leading through the mysteries. In the earliest centuries of Christianity, mystagogy referred to the practice of helping Christians to appreciate more deeply the Christian mysteries into which they had been initiated by baptism, confirmation, and reception of the Eucharist. This period of formation allowed newly initiated believers to deepen their spiritual, liturgical, and community lives. This present program of Mystagogy is being developed and taught by Barbara Nicolosi Harrington, a university professor of screenwriting, cinema, great books, and theology. The first series of the program focused on prayer as the underpinning of Catholic discipleship. The second series highlighted the Catholic legacy of art, story, music, and poetry. In the third series, starting today, Barbara will break open Dante's Divine Comedy in order to explore the themes of sin, suffering, virtue, and holiness. Today's presentation provides an introduction to Dante Alighieri and the first cantos of the Divine Comedy.
So let's jump in and get started. So you were supposed to look at cantos 1-4, which are pre-hell, a little bit of getting into it. And then next week, we'll really jump in with the sins of the flesh and looking at a couple of, basically what I'm going to do is pick out a couple of examples or stories in some of the cantos, because we can't possibly do all of them. But I love in canto 5, Francesca and Paolo. It's one of my favorite, and it's probably one of the most famous stories in the Inferno. But anyway, let's jump in here. And a lot of the artwork that I'm using is this Gustave Odore. He just did like scores and scores of images to this work. He was obsessed with this work, and you can get the book. And they're mostly black and white. They're all black and white kind of sketches, but just fantastic stuff. So a lot of the images are going to be from him, and you can tell the style, huh? But this is supposed to be Pilgrim Dante lost in the woods, and so we'll get there, okay? So just quickly, the Divine Comedy encompasses Dante's vision of God's judgment on every significant aspect of human life. There is probably nothing in there. There's nothing you can really come up with in the moral or spiritual life that he doesn't touch on in some way. And in fact, you have T.S. Eliot saying, there's Shakespeare and Dante, and that's it, right? Like that, between the two of them, everything, every human is going to come up. Absolutely, without question, the supreme culminating work of medieval thought. So he's coming along 100 years after Thomas Aquinas, basically, and St. Francis, and he is like really synthesizing how the church, how Christians understood themselves. And it's very important for that, because this predates the Reformation by 300 years. So you do get a sense of where Christendom was from this work, what Christians, how they thought about things. So yeah, okay. Power of love, public morality, spiritual salvation, all of these things are going to be what we're going to be looking at. Just a couple things about Dante. He's one of those people who we refer to by his first name because he's Oprah. There's not that many people. Cher, Oprah, Dante, they can get away with it, and you know who they are. But he's actually Alighieri, lived from 1265 to 1321, not like 56 years there, right? Something like that. So didn't live a long time. He was a linguist, a philosopher, a politician, and a poet. And very much into politics, really was concerned that politics was the way the world, that we Christians were supposed to keep the world together and running smoothly by the political realm. And he comes to get and question that. But he was what's called a white Guelph, which, so there were two parties. There were the Ghibellines and the Guelphs. and the Democrats and the Republicans. But then in the Guelph side, the Republicans, they split into two. And so there's white Guelphs and black Guelphs. And the white Guelphs were basically opposed to the papal political power. So one of the things that has happened is that the Pope has all these lands in central Italy, and the Holy Roman Emperor kind of crawls down and he gets the top part of Italy. And so he's got that. And then the Pope has the middle of Italy. And then through a chain of events, the Holy Roman Emperor also gets South Italy. So for the first time in history, the papal states are wedged in between this greedy for power political leader. And so Pope Boniface VIII decides he's not going to put up with this, and he is going to fight, and he's going to be a real political leader. And so the white Guelphs basically oppose him, and so Pope Boniface excommunicates the entire city of Florence for opposing him. So Dante, like Joan of Arc, is someone who died excommunicate and then was repatriated in 1921. Pope Benedict XV wrote an encyclical on the Divine Comedy in which he says, oh, by the way, we've made our peace with Dante. He's in heaven. But the city of Florence didn't forgive him until 2008. Even though his statues are everywhere and everything, he was officially still an exile of Florence until 2008. Huh? But that's how the centuries that we Italians, we don't forget. Okay. But quite a story. And so basically the Divine Comedy, he's in exile. He's kicked out of his beautiful hometown that he loves, of Florence. They confiscate his lands and his family money. His kids hate him. He's completely cut off. He's excommunicated. And he's like in his mid-30s. And basically he's like, how did I get here? What happened? This was not my plan. And this is the spirit that the Divine Comedy comes out of, which is basically Dante the Pilgrim. How did I get here? And the way he's going to figure it out is, the thing he's going to say is factionalism, that the root of all evil and sin, that the cause or the effect of all sin is division. Factions. So divisions in your own family. Sin causes divisions in your family. It causes divisions in your friendships. It causes divisions in your community. It causes division in your country. Causes divisions in your own heart and soul. Factions. And so he sees this. He was a white Guelph in one faction against the black Guelphs, against the Ghibellines, and these factions just destroying Italy. And so he's like looking at that. He's like, that sin's effect is division. There are currently in print 100 English translations of the Divine Comedy. And you've got tons of music and artwork and painting, but especially listen to Tchaikovsky and Liszt, both wrote music inspired by this. You can find a ton of it, by the way, though. And there's some video games, too, if that's your thing, right? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so just the structure of this thing is astounding in itself. Three parts, right? Inferno, Purgatorio, Paradiso, which have each 33 cantos. Canto chapter, right? But it's supposed to be like sung. 33 little songs and one for the introduction, which means there's 100. Perfect. Each canto is in lines of three, and each line has 11 syllables. So every stanza is 33 syllables. Every thing. And this is like the stuff of you're going out of your mind, dude. But he's so brilliant. And there's this order to this thing that you begin to appreciate more and more as you go. Now, why do we call it the Divine Comedy? A few reasons. First of all, because it's not theology. This is supposed to be a whopping good tale, an epic poem like Homer. He's not teaching theology. Having said that, he hews really close to theology. He's the most with Joan of Arc, the two most orthodox people you can imagine, both excommunicated, right? But he's not so concerned with giving you a theology of the last things. That's not what this is. And I always tell my students, I teach in an evangelical university, or primarily, although we're taking over. No, I'm only kidding. But no, yeah, one of my students is here. But I just said that for you. But anyway, but I always have to assure them this is not Catholic teaching on purgatory, etc. It's, and I'm going to say a little bit about that, but it's meant to be basically. Charles Dickens rips this work off when he does the intervention by the spirits to save Ebenezer Scrooge. It's based on this, that Dante the Pilgrim is a lost cause, except that God intervenes and makes him go on this journey. Okay. Number two, the reason it's a comedy is because it isn't a tragedy, because at the end he's in heaven. So if it ended with the inferno and he's stuck there clinging to Satan's fur, this would have been a tragedy. But it ends with a happy, so good. Also, it was written in lowly Italian as opposed to lofty Latin. And serious works were written in Latin. And so, yeah, for the everyday people. So that's another reason with commedia, this is for common people. Huh? And the word komos, which is the root of comedy from the Greek, means a carnival. Or a really rousing party. So from Dante's standpoint, how we end up in heaven is God's carnival. It's a divine comedy, how he gets us up there, okay? Okay, so what I'm going to lay out here is six principles about the divine comedy in the Inferno, like three and three, I think, that you have to internalize to really understand the work and what's going on, okay? So, number one, for Dante, there are really only two destinations, heaven and hell. And purgatory is the antechamber to heaven. So, it's like if you get to purgatory in the Divine Comedy, you're in heaven, you're on the trajectory to heaven. So there's really only those two. This is a some church or something. Anyway, one of the great artists painted this whole thing of heaven, and purgatory is here, and then hell down here, and the purgatory crowd, they're going up there, and then they're joining the blessed. Very cool. Here's that part there, so quite gorgeous, all the details there. Okay, number two, the path to paradise begins in hell. Dante's thesis is you cannot understand heaven. You cannot appreciate heaven if you don't go down. So we see as he's going through these circles of hell, right? And then at the very end, we're going to see to get out of hell, he's literally got to climb up the disgusting fur of Satan, who's frozen in the ice, and Satan is chewing on the heads of Judas and Brutus, so their brain matter and blood is all over the place. And Dante looks at it and he's like, I don't want to go near that. And Virgil's like, you must. You have to go right up to this sin and climb up. It has to be real, this battle with sin. And so that's what he's trying to do here, is by telling all the stories, we're going to meet all these sinners and they're going to tell their stories and how they got there and why and all this stuff. And Dante wants you to go, what's my story about that sin? You have to look and see and look at these sins and then understand, I need a savior. Okay. Paradise. As Flannery O'Connor says, there's no point in the resurrection if there wasn't a reason for it in the lives we live. Right? You can't skip Good Friday. Principle three, we're going to find sinners in all three levels. There's sinners in purgatory, there's sinners in heaven. The difference is in hell, they're unrepentant. that hell, it's not what you've done that puts you in hell. It's your refusal to ask for divine grace. So Romans 2, huh? Because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath against yourself for the day of God's wrath, when his righteous judgment will be revealed. God will give to each person according to what he has done. But this unrepentant heart thing, and you see in Isaiah, we have stony hearts, and they've just got to be cracked open by sorrow and repentance. And so it's so cool. We will meet people in purgatory who commit almost exactly the same heinous sin as somebody we met in hell. But they're in purgatory. We're going to meet heretics in heaven. Because they didn't fail in love. Their problem wasn't that they didn't love. Their problem was excess. But in the end, they repent of whatever failing they had. Okay, so it's really cool and encouraging. Principle 4. The souls in hell have lost the true use of reason. They are liars and generally crazy. I got in trouble once a few years ago in California for saying, in hell, everyone's crazy. And one of my students reported that Professor Harrington said, my family, we struggle with depression, that we're all going to hell. So I had to go in and explain, I did not say that, although you're making me think that is a likely. No, it's not. But anyway, you're going to see this weird, like, they can be. There's some of the people in hell are just brilliant. They're self-possessed. They're charming. They're articulate. And they're nuts. And he wants you to think about that. What is it about sin that in the end makes us lose touch with what is real and true? Principle 5, the geography of hell and then some of purgatory is determined by the sins of those in each place. So the sins create the climate. In hell, the sinners are getting exactly what they have wanted in their lives on earth. So their whole lives, they wanted this sin, and God's grace kept messing up their sin lives. Kept knocking on the door at the wrong time, kept sending somebody in to disturb them, kept making them they just can't really enjoy their sin. So finally, after death, God pulls back and says, have at it. And they get it. And that creates the weather. It creates the punishment, in a sense, that they end up having to suffer. Now, in purgatory, their sins determine their cure, which looks like punishment, but isn't. It's a cure. And I personally like the Purgatorio the best of all three, because it really is about the spiritual life and how we can get over some of our stuff by rethinking things. But there's all these cool methods that he ascribes to God to heal these souls that you're like, huh, I think I'm going to try that. I'm not going to sew my eyes shut. Like the vain or the envious. But the idea of that, you know, that envy's problem is it's fueled by looking and et cetera. Okay, so this is an example of the pride in purgatory, the prideful. We meet them bent over by huge rocks on their back, and they're forced to look at the ground where there's tales all through scriptural tales and literature of people doing beautiful, humble, great works and having to look at it, right? And it's all on the walls around them as they start to be able to stand. And then, so they're surrounded by beautiful, great works that they didn't do. And this is one way to get over your pride. Look at what other people do. Okay. So number 6, the cast of characters we're going to meet are from history and from fiction and from Dante's life, especially. A lot of people he has issues with. Pope Boniface VIII does not get away with it. But they're all mixed up. Real people, literary people, whatever. And then people, a lot of the people that we're going to meet that are from Italy and his are like his parents' generation. So it's a little safer. He's talking about things that happened. So for us, it would be like stuff that happened in the 60s and 70s. That's about the time period he's writing about stories that happened then. Okay. Okay. All right. So those are the principles to be thinking about while we're reading this thing, huh? Don't trust the sinners in hell. They lie and they're nuts. Okay, just always keep that in the back of your mind. And the sinners in purgatory always tell the truth. So here's the map of hell, and it's basically this massive cone with the most common sins at the top, the sins that most people get stuck in, end up getting damned for. Our Lady at Fatima said more people go to hell for sins of the flesh than any other sins. Having said that, the punishments aren't quite as bad as when you get down to the very bottom where you're with the traitorous, those who have betrayed the good. And yeah, you got Judas and Brutus being chewed up, their brains being chewed on from all eternity by Satan himself, right? That's really bad. But the punishments get worse as the crime gets worse. Having said that, you have this kind of massive number in the sins of the flesh area, which is what we're going to look at next week. And actually, we're going to look at, before we even get there, the biggest circle there. But this is how it works in his geography. And what's interesting is when you get all the way to the bottom, and then they climb down Satan, who's upside down, because he fell from heaven, clunk, and his head's frozen in the ice. They climb down him and come up in the shores of purgatory, and it's, oh, this is all inverted. You know, anyway, very cool. All right. Okay, so let's say a word about Dante the Pilgrim. So this is, Dante is telling this story where he's made himself a character. And he's really tough on himself. Dante the Pilgrim is a mess. The story he's created here is divine intervention to help him. And you're going to see, we're going to see that he's cowardly. He's licentiate still. Like, he listens to the story of Paolo and Francesca, and he's weeping. Oh, it's such a beautiful romantic story. Like, they're in hell. And Virgil slaps him on the side of the head. But he's proud. He meets a Ferinata, pops up and says, what family are you from? And it's, my family is the best family. And they're sitting there fighting over this. He's ignorant about everything having to do with the spiritual life. And he's irresolute. So he can't get himself going and staying. He keeps needing grace to drag him and push him. Finally, he's doing it all for the wrong reason. And we're going to see that basically he's doing it because he starts out the right thing, and then this girl, Beatrice, that got away. And he's about to give up on trying to get his act together, and then he gets word, it's Beatrice. And he's like, Beatrice? Okay, I'll go. So he's not even doing it for God. We used to say in the convent, God can work with that. Whatever it is that has gotten you to do the right thing, God can work with that. Wrong. The thing is, get your motives right, but don't stop doing the good. And so there it is, okay? So this is the character through whom we're going to be listening to this story. Okay, so let's really start now, huh? The dark wood of error is where the divine comedy begins, the inferno begins. And we have this amazing prose, and I guess I'll read it because I'm up here. But anyway, okay. Midway along the journey of our life, I woke to find myself in a dark wood. for I wandered off from the straight path. How hard it is to tell what it was like, this wood of wilderness, savage and stubborn. The thought of it brings back all my old fears. A bitter place. Death could scarce be bitterer. But if I would show the good that came of it, I must talk about things other than the good. There it is again. We've got to look at the darkness in order to be appreciative of the light and to understand the light. So, midway through the journey of life, this is middle age. There's a great series. This is one, two of these photographs are from it. Woman took all these pictures of what it is to be middle-aged, and there's a book there. I guess you have to, can't really read it without adult beverages, but there it is. This is right. What is it to be middle-aged? Huh? How did I get here? How did I get here? This wasn't what I meant. This wasn't at all one of my dreams when I was 22. Isn't that a great little... How did I get here? What else is out here with me? So he says, I went astray from the straight road. He's basically saying it's going to be two things we're going to find out. Not only hasn't he been talking to God in his midlife, he's gotten out of the habit of it, but he's also gotten out of the habit of even listening to things rationally, even thinking rationally. Because when he meets Virgil, that's a voice I haven't heard for a while. Savage and stubborn, a bitter place. So this is a metaphor for somebody who is having a moment of grace. And they realize my life is a mess. It's out of control. This is not a good life. This is not what I meant to be. I should be better than this. Can you relate anybody to going through moments like, okay, there you go, Mike. Yeah. Okay, you can leave now because the rest of us have our act together. But that idea of that's actually a good thing. If you find yourself all of a sudden, what am I doing? The thought of it brings back all my old fears. What are your old fears? So what does that mean? Anybody? All my old fears have been now haunting me since I've had this realization that my life is not what it should be. What are the old fears?
Abandonment would be one.
What do you mean? Abandonment. Okay.
You're fearful that maybe your parents, if it's power they were raised, trust and they feel that abandonment.
Oh, I think that's a great one. Abandonment. So as a child, as a young person, you're like, I'm going to find somebody who makes my life work, who will take care of me and love me. And that's going to happen, right? Somewhere around 33. It's just going to happen. And then I'm done. I won't have to worry anymore. What's another old fear of youth that comes back and starts like in midlife? Failure. I'm going to be one of the cool people. I'm going to have the respect or whatever your thing is. I'm going to be a lawyer or I'm going to be a doctor or I'm going to have a Porsche or I'm not going to have to worry about money by the time I'm 50. Think about that. As a young person, you are worried about, I don't want to be in this like rat racy thing my whole life. Anything else? Any other fear you have of youth that all of a sudden is right back in your brain? Yes.
I'd say they go together with each other, but mortality and time.
Okay. Mortality and time. Say a couple more words about that.
So when you're younger, you don't think about death. There's the old adage, right? Live forever and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And as you get older, you've been through some stuff, you've maybe had some illness or some injuries, and now you realize that you're not invincible.
Yeah.
But as far as time goes, especially as you start to descend into levels of hell, these sins that you made earlier on, or these mistakes, or these abandonments, these things that you didn't come back to address, they're now forever.
There they are. Yeah. I remember when I was like little, and the absolute, I thought this for many years, the man, you will not be alive by the time you're 56. That's like a ridiculous age. But I remember too thinking when the year 2000 would hit, I'd be like, oh my gosh, I'll be like too old to enjoy it. I would be 36. And now it's like 56, you're a baby. It's looking younger all the time. Anyway, think about this. That this is, though, a moment of grace. There's two ways people handle this realization. One is called midlife crisis, where, oh, I have to make a big change and try to grab for my youth and meaning in some ridiculous way. Yeah, I'm going to make up for lost time. I'm going to double down on something that didn't work and just spend more money. Or you say, huh, how can I now turn to God and really start making this ascent to him with the time I have left? One of the things I want to, because he uses darkness a lot in the Inferno, it's dark and cold. There's not a lot of fire in the Inferno, which is really interesting. It's cold and dark. Huh? Why are we afraid of the dark? It seems to me one of the reasons is because there's other things out there in the dark that are better at darkness than we are. It's not really our natural terrain. And that's why we don't walk in the woods at night. This is not where I belong. Number two, we can't see. We can't see, so we don't feel safe. And then number three, it really feels like death, darkness. So all three of these things are part of this moment of grace that Dante is being called to have to weather. You're going to have to be in the dark wood. You're going to have to deal with your fears, huh? Your inadequacy, and your powerlessness. That's going to be part of this. And if you experience fear and inadequacy, it's not that you're doing the spiritual journey thing wrong. It's just that you're doing it. Because we have to enter into the reality about ourselves. He says, I know not how I got there, so drugged and loose with sleep I had become. So there's a thought, right? So drugged and loose with sleep I had become. What is that? That in our lives we get used to taking the drug. Okay, very good, huh? My drug. What are your drugs that distract you off of really the life that God is calling you to, huh? Busyness, competition, weird little head game battles with friends, family, whatever. That's my big, like, sewer of cistern of depth to dive in head first. But whatever these things are, is that drug that I've learned to take so that I can keep walking has really just made me go, how did I get here now? And then sleep is the other issue. Literally, I am just going to not be awake around things that are embarrassing to me, my failures. I'm just going to go to sleep. And when I wake up, you know, I'll be okay for another few hours. Okay, so that's where he is. And he's in this dark woods. And then all of a sudden, he sees a glimmer of light in the distance. He says, but at the far end of that valley of evil, That planet who's shining, that planet who's shining strengthens me against the fright. So he sees this like orb of light in the distance up on a mountain. And he goes, that's where I have to go. And it gives him encouragement, right? So this is grace. This is God sending you some kind of sign. I'm here, over here. Right? And it can be through the love of a friend or some kind of miracle or something that just makes you go, I'm not alone. There is a God and he knows my name and he loves me. Whatever that is. And so we're going to surge towards it, right? And so he does. Except all of a sudden, and lo, almost at the beginning of the rise, I faced a spotted leopard, all tremor and flow and gaudy pelt. Now, I have a different interpretation of these three animals than pretty much everyone else who is wrong. It doesn't make any sense to me that it would be out of order. Nothing in this book is out of order. So I think the first animal is the first three levels of hell, the first section of hell, which is incontinence. A lot of other people think that this one's fraud. No, they're wrong. It doesn't make any sense. Having said that, here we go. You're getting my take on it, huh? But when I hear this, the leopard, all tremor and flow and gaudy pelt, that sounds like sex to me. So the first thing that stops us from seeking God when we're in that moment of grace, what has happened to me? And then before we fall asleep again, we get an inspiration to try to change and try to find God. And then boom, the leopard, sensuality. And lo, almost at the beginning of the rise. So sensuality, incontinence is really the word that Dante is looking at here. And it's this whole realm of sins that are out, something being out of balance. So some of them are physical, like sexuality out of balance, where you make it too important. Like that's out of whack. Or food. Think of the sins we're going to see next week. Gluttony is the disproportionate focus on use of food. But we're going to see hoarders and wasters who use stuff the wrong way, either too miserly or too profligate. So we're going to see these people that are out of balance, but we're also going to see at the end of this section is the heretics. Because it's like heretics have a disproportionate sense of their own intelligence. I'm right, everyone else is wrong. Except sometimes you are the only one who's right. But Teresa of Avila says, our body has this defect, that the more it is provided care and comforts, the more it needs and desires it finds. So the more you let the body have its way, the more the body gets dictatorial. So the three types of sin we're going to see are incontinence is the first level, which is the lack of balance, the lack of self-control. And it's going to be in this all these different areas. Then we're going to see violence, and then we're going to see fraud. But the question that Dante wants you to think about, and this is what we're going to see next week when we meet all these sinners who are caught up in these imbalances, is how do the sins of the flesh divert us from intimacy with God? How do they actually do that? Why is it that if you indulge your desire to have the best wardrobe, the best car, why is that going to get between you and God? Because it becomes your God. It's the thing you turn to give you meaning and happiness. I love that. Interesting. So that's something to look at. Another group that I'm going to love. I don't think we meet them till purgatory. The Chippies of Florence. And the Chippies of Florence are these women who would hang out the windows with their breasts exposed. It was like the prostitute street in Florence. And he says the immodest are actually gluttons for attention. That's the imbalance there. Isn't that interesting? It's not with the carnal in that sense. That's not what they're looking for. What they're looking for is this need to be thought of as beautiful. Really cool stuff, huh? But this is what he wants you to ask yourself. My little thing that I tell myself I need, how is that getting between me and God? Can't serve two masters. You will love one and despise the other. Very good. Okay, so he starts to dodge the leopard and like squeeze his way around. And all of a sudden, I shook with dread at the sight of a great lion. I didn't realize this was had somebody's credits on it there. Oh, that broke upon me raging with hunger. Its enormous head held high. As if to strike. So this is the next level of sins. The second beast, the thing that's going to get between us and God on this journey is going to be violence. But it's really, for Dante, wrathful violence. So your rage is what the second level of sins and all the things that how it acts makes you act out. I'm jealous, I'm envious, I hate that I'm not the top dog, I hate that I got a raw deal. All of these things, which are essentially anger at God for our lot in life. Why did you give me cancer? Why did you make my son die? Why am I not smarter? Why am I not more beautiful? Whatever it is that you're nurturing, that's anger that then makes you act out violently. Okay? So the sins of violence, huh? So I say the heretics are right at the in between the immoderate and the violent, which is really cool, huh? But he basically says there's three kinds of sins of violence. You can be violent against other people, which is murder and theft and all of those things, huh? You can be violent against yourself. This is all kinds of perversions, not accepting who you are in God's eyes, who he's made you. We can be violent against God and reject his plan, his whatever. Okay. So he starts to squeeze away from the lion and the leopard, and he's running now to get away from them, and boom, he comes face to face with the worst one of all. This she-wolf, she drove upon me a starved horror, ravening and wasted beyond all belief. See, to me, like people will say this is sensuality. I'm like, no, this is lies because she's a starved horror, right? She looks horrifying, but she's actually starved and she's beyond all belief. See, but anyway, lies. The third thing that's going to get between us and God is lies. What kind of lies keep us from intimacy with God? Vincent de Paul says the big lie, the number one big lie is pride, which tells you, I got this. I'm basically a good person. I'm in control. It's not my fault. God and I, we get each other. You know, there's this new commercial on right now. Have you seen it? He gets us. Anyway, it's Jesus was poor and blah, 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 and Jesus felt bad and he gets us. So I'm like, oh yeah, he gets us. It's like, you don't know the half of it. But anyway, not quite the way. Having said that, humility, according to Vincent de Paul, is nothing but truth. Yet the humble person doesn't sit there, I'm a carpet. They say, I know I'm not God. I know I'm fallible. I know I'm pathetic. I know I'm loved. That's humility. Pride can't say anything simply at all. Pride is incapable of the simple truth. But we can think of other lies, huh? And believe me, we're going to meet a whole bunch of people who are lying. And all the different lies that they are telling that justify. Okay, so at this point he goes, forget it. I'm just going to dig a hole and I'm not even going to try because I can't do war with all of these things in myself. These three beasts are too much for me. So all of a sudden, boom, Virgil appears. Virgil is sent, we're going to hear, is sent basically by these three women, Mary, St. Lucy, and Beatrice. The three women are all in cahoots to save his soul. And so they send Virgil. Virgil is the greatest of the Roman poets, right? He wrote the Aeneid. And the Aeneid has a journey into the afterlife. Dante is a poet. So he's sent a poet by God. So, oh, you and me, we're buds. Yeah, you get me, huh? But he reveres him, but he trusts him because he's one like himself. Now, Virgil symbolizes two things. One is grace. We cannot do this journey on our own. We cannot look at ourselves and see ourselves on our own. We cannot fix ourselves. Like all of these, that Virgil has to be there as his guide. And he's going to take him all the way up until heaven. And then Beatrice is going to take over. Because human reason can't understand heaven. Beatrice, who symbolizes love and God's mercy, is going to take it from there. But hell and purgatory is this rational enterprise for Dante. Okay, so basically, over and over, the way Virgil works with Dante the Pilgrim is when Dante starts to act emotionally, he's snap out of it. Right? When he starts to weep, or when he's terrified, or when, and all these things, when he's facing his sins, when he's facing the challenges, he's facing all these things start to come up, and he gets emotional. And then reason, Virgil plays, sit back, calm down, don't make this an emotional thing. Just keep walking and learning, right? And that over and over, that is the voice that needs to accompany this journey. Virgil, he says, when he starts to talk, he seemed hoarse from long silence. In other words, the voice of reason in Dante's life has been not something he's been listening to. He's gotten away from it. He's been partying. He's been being an activist. He's been in all this political stuff and fighting the Pope and all of these things. Everything but looking at himself in terms of where am I with God. Okay. Any questions or comments up to now? Because this is the end of Canto 1. Is that he says, okay, Virgil, I'm going to trust you to get me through these dark woods. Yes.
Do we know anything about Dante's actual spirituality? Was he a devout person?
Yes. I think he really was. Having said that, he's owning that he had gotten very distracted by all these other things that he had gotten into. And that caused him, you know, he cannot deny his life is a mess. And even if he's right about the Pope not needing so much political power, obviously the way I did it was wrong. Everything, everybody hates me. Everything I valued has been taken from me. And not because I was good and virtuous.
Did he say one more question?
Yes.
Did he see success with this work in his own life? Or was it later?
It starts to immediately. Having said that, he dies in exile. I believe. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. The exile is not lifted. So he dies of a broken heart, really. Yeah. Okay, Canto 2. So that's just the beginning. That was just number 1. Okay. All right, number 2. It starts out,
okay, what am I doing? You know what? I can't do this. I can't do this. Nope. You know what? I'm just going to go back to sleep, and this will all have been a dream. So, right away, after he's been given this divine guide, he panics and backs out. And so, he has to get the word, the message from Beatrice. I want you, baby. I'm waiting for you. She's not really. She married somebody else. She was the one who got away. But he's obsessed with her. Anyway, when he hears about Beatrice being the one that's involved, then he goes, hey, she likes me. Maybe I can do this. So he sets out to find Beatrice, not God. And again, how many things in our lives do we do the right thing for the wrong reason? And it's like you look back at it and you're like, yeah, I married that guy, but I wasn't really. Or, yeah, I took that college course or I took that degree program. I had a student once who was an amazing writer, and she was in nursing. And she told me, I can't stand sick people. I just want to throw up when I'm around smells and blood. And I'm like, then why are you in the nursing program? She goes, you'll always have a job, won't you? I was like, I don't want you putting and sticking me with a needle with that attitude. But so it's for all the wrong reasons. Huh? So I talked her out of it. She's a very happy writer now. Poor, but happy. Okay. But think about this. What's your Beatrice that God might have to use to get you moving? Is it fear for your kids? It's like, you know what? If it's just me and God, I got time. But my kid's an addict. Now I have to get really serious about this praying stuff. Or my kids leaving the church or outside the church. Or my husband, he's needs something and I can't do it. What is your Beatrice that God will have to use? Because he knows he himself is probably not a big enough draw. So he's fine. He can work with whatever our little obsession is. As Flannery O'Connor says, if God had to wait for us to have a pure motive, for most of us, he will be waiting our entire lives. So he'll use whatever. But it's really good to start getting a handle on that, isn't it? Why do I really do what I do? How is my faith transactional in some way, where I'm doing this because I'm expecting that? Or I'm doing this because I'm powerless in front of that and it scares me. But see, that's not love. But God can work with it. Okay, so that's basically all of Canto 2 is getting him on the road because of Beatrice. It reminds me, it's a little bit different, but Father Benedict Groeschel, I remember once him saying, you can say the wrong prayer to the wrong God, but in the right way and be heard. Or you can say the right prayer to the right God in the wrong way and not be heard. God can work with it. Okay. All right. Canto 3, The Gates of Hell. Probably the most famous, one of the most famous lines in all of Western civilization literature, huh? Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. This is a painting of the threshold to hell here, huh? So let's just read what they see when they find this gate now in the middle of the dark wood, and this is what's over it, huh? Now, your translation or our translation has I am. I love that for one reason, because it's Trinitarian and all of this. But actually, the real Italian, it should be through me. Okay, so the gate is speaking here. Through me, the way into the suffering city. Through me, the way to the eternal pain. Through me, the way that runs among the lost. Justice urged on my high artificer, my maker was divine authority, the highest wisdom and the primal love. Before me, nothing but eternal things were made, and I endure eternally, abandon every hope, ye that enters here. So we could unpack this for a really long time, but I can't believe it's already 8:30. Can we do just like 10 more minutes?
Sure.
Is it okay? All right, good. Sorry. I've got to stop with my stories. Okay. But this basically is saying that hell was a creation of divine love to let those who rejected him have their playground. That our will, God made us free, and he spends our whole life trying to get us to choose the good, the true, the beautiful himself. But in the end, he will respect our freedom, because if he takes it away, we're no longer human. So God says, okay, you have rejected me. Here's your place. Have at it. Really interesting. Okay. So Virgil says, right after they pass through the gate, and he says, just so you know, here you will pass among the fallen people, souls who have lost the good of intellect. That is, everybody here is stupid in one way or another. Okay. All right. Now, so they go through the gate and they see the mob, the biggest horde of souls they're going to see in the entire hell is here. And it's this group of people naked, chasing after a person up front with a banner with nothing on it. And they're running. Meanwhile, they're getting bitten by wasps and bees that are goading them to run further and faster. And they're running and running. And all eyes saw a whirling banner that ran so fast it seemed as though it could never find rest. At once with certainty, I understood this was that worthless crew, hateful alike to God and to his foes. These wretches who never were alive ran naked in a swarm of wasps and hornets that goaded them. Here's another artistic rendering of this, the naked nameless, huh? So these are people who basically, this was their creed. Whatever. It's a reference to a movie called Night of the Hunter in the 50s, where a man who's a murderer has good tattooed on one hand and evil on the other, and he's fighting this, which is it? A lot of people just say, who cares? Leave me alone. Huh? So these are the soulless whose lives concluded neither blame nor praise. Jesus says, be you hot or cold. If you're lukewarm, I will spit you out of my... Actually, I will vomit you out of my mouth. That there is the biggest group of damned in hell are people who neither chose the good nor the evil, but were careful taking care of their own interests not to commit. Mm-hmm. It's the scariest part for me, right? He says a big group of the people, of the souls that are here, are all these fallen angels who couldn't choose between Satan and God and stood on the sidelines and said, I'm just going to see how this comes out, hedging their bets, neither for God nor Satan, but only for themselves. This is where he finds Pope Celestine V, who was the first pope to resign. And he had been basically a hermit and a holy man, and the cardinals had been voting for 27 months. You think we have problems? They've been in conclave for 27 months, and they couldn't pick a pope. So he was a hermit, and he sent him a message, pick somebody already! And so they said, oh, okay, how about you? Plop! And he didn't want to be pope. He was terrible, just terrible. So 3 months later, he resigned, knowing that the guy who was going to win was Boniface VIII, who Dante hates, and who does get lots and lots of trouble for the church. And so Dante's, you shouldn't have resigned, Celestine. That was bad. Imagine leaving the church at the mercy of... No, I can't even imagine it. Anyway. But here you go, huh? This idea. So Dante's, you know what? Be wrong. Or be right. But live. Choose. Don't sit there sucking your thumb on the side and not commit. And let's keep it, let's make the rubber meet the road here, right? You're surrounded by some people who are doing things that you know are destructive. Okay, look, not my problem. There's somebody in your life that God has put there that needs you to say the simple truth in love. Nope. I don't want to get in trouble. Like that idea of it's better to do it wrong, but having do Esther fast for a week, dress yourself up, make the best case you can, and try. And then whether you fail or succeed is in God's hands. But not to try when we see bad things, evil happening, and it's given to us that we know we're being called. It's not an accident that I'm here. So this is big for Dante. I think he's right. All right, now the last thing here is the beach at Acheron. This is the rude awakening place where the newly damned are plopped down into the water. And then they get in the rowboat by this awful mythological character who beats them as he rows them over into hell proper. And it's an anti-birth scene, huh? Where you have, this is the text, as leaves in autumn loosen and stream down, so one by one the evil seed of Adam cast themselves down. They yearn for what they fear. So they, their whole life, they've been fighting to do this wicked thing they want, but they are a little afraid of it. So Dante says, as an act of mercy at the end, God takes away their fear so they can enjoy it. And but in this place, but it's like this, plop, plop, and then people are coming up out of the water, this putrid, filthy water, as like an anti-baptism. Really cool. They are now being... They're dying in the water in a different way. Okay, and this is what you hear. He says, in despair, these people who are coming up, they're drowning, they're splashing around, they're climbing under the boat. They blasphemed God. How did I get here, God? Their parents, if you would only raise me better. Their time on earth. If I had been born in 1200, I would be a much better person. The race of Adam, it's not my fault. It's this stupid body. And the day and hour that gave them birth. You know what? February. If I wasn't a Pisces. Whatever, huh? Who's missing on this list? Themselves. They're cursing everybody else. His fault, her fault, their fault, not me. And that is what makes hell. Whereas when we go ahead into purgatory in heaven, everybody's accountable. So, accountability. If you play the blame game, you're on the side of hell. Just saying. Yes.
I forget if it was in the front section notes or some of the footnotes, which are marvelous, by the way, but I got a darker sense than that, that these folks going to hell, there was a glib statement by Ciardi. He said, you really got to want to go to hell. So they knew what they were doing was bad.
Yeah.
And yet they still wanted it.
Yeah.
The more darker of it.
Yeah.
That was his.
Yeah. I think he's right about that, that in the end, everybody in hell gets what the thing they thought they wanted, and that God gives them the grace of, yeah, of there's not going to get anything now in the way of you having this thing you want, and truly left to their own free devices, free there. So it's very dark. Yeah. But this question of who am I blaming? Just so you know, the blaming is not a chorus that you hear in purgatory or heaven. That's a chorus you only hear in hell. Interesting. We used to say in the convent, if people broke you, it's an explanation, but not an excuse. Yeah. Welcome to the Divine Comedy. So next week we'll do the sins of the flesh. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Mystagogy podcast. The music for this podcast is provided by George Serra. You can learn more about George and his music via a link in the show notes. Until next time, be well and God bless.